You're listening to a Hebrew in Israel podcast with Yoel Halevi, exploring the language, culture, and history of the Bible. For more information, visit us at HebrewInIsrael.net.
Shalom everyone, Yoel here again with another episode of Tzor LaMikra. I hope you've enjoyed the recordings up to now. And as always, for those who are new to this, welcome. This week, we have, at least for me, a fascinating subject, a subject that I've been involved in for many, many years, and I even had the privilege of studying under some of the most famous people in this field up to now, and it's the subject of the temple, though temple service is not really part of the discussion here. But the temple and the temple vestments and everything basically has to do with temples. And I actually started my saga with the temple when I was about 7 or 8 years old. I don't remember exactly. And it started off with two little booklets, one yellow, one blue, that we had to study for school. And here in Israel, Bible studies are mandatory in schools, especially the type of school I went to, which was a religious but state school, which means that we have several hours of religious studies. If it's Torah, which at that stage it was mostly studying the Tanakh, and later on they also started introducing Mishnah and Talmud, but the first couple of years of being in school, we mostly focused on the Tanakh, which meant we started with Genesis, we studied Genesis I think for 2 years. Then in the third grade, we got into Exodus. Leviticus was pushed into the fifth grade because of some subjects there which are too complex for children. But essentially, by the sixth grade, we went through the entire Torah as children. And we went through Joshua, Judges, Samuel. And then when you go into the seventh grade, you go through again through a cycle. So, for example, in the seventh grade, we did Exodus. In the eighth grade, we did Numbers. They played around with it. But essentially, the whole idea is that they try to give you, by the 12th grade, they want to cover certain books that give you not only the background of our people, but also, touching a lot of things. So I really started biblical studies, I would say, when I was in first grade. But when I call it biblical studies, because we really had to discuss, even from a very young age, the interpretation of different commentators, Jewish commentators, especially when we went into high school, became very prominent. But we were also, by high school, we were also discussing even non-traditional commentators, especially with certain teachers that I had in high school that were very aware of some of the touchiness that certain people have with non-traditional commentators. So we actually did speak about, for example, Umberto Casuto, who's a very, very famous commentator, and one of the people who stood against the document hypothesis. He actually wrote a commentary on Genesis until the death of Abraham, and he wrote a commentary on Exodus, and I've been using these commentaries for years. Some people ask me if I've ever heard of them. I said, what do you mean? These are some of the most classic commentators that everyone here in Israel knows about. Because the thing is that the commentary that one of his students wrote, which is Hartom, it was published, and it's still popular to this very day. I mean, for me, it's already low grade type of material because he doesn't go in depth like other commentaries that I have. But it was considered to be a classic commentary. It was the first time someone, and this is from the 1960s, 1970s, it was the first time someone wrote an Israeli or / Jewish commentary that's really scientific. I mean, up to that point, you had commentaries like, for example, Rabbi Hoffman, a very, very interesting rabbi from Germany. He died at like the age of 94, somewhere in the early 20th century he died. And he as a rabbi and as a scholar, wrote commentaries that responded to what was going on in the world. But Hartom, basically a student, and I even think he was his son-in-law of Casuto, Hartom actually created a very accessible scholarly-like commentary that was in a language that, first of all, wasn't trying to deal with what was going on in the commentary world, but was also, you know, trying to create original commentary. So there's a lot of interesting stuff there. It's considered to be a classic, especially for people who go to secular schools. Kasuto is like classic. When I hear people say, oh, these academics, what are you talking about? This is stuff that we learned in high school. So it always makes me laugh a little bit. But also Kasuto, the Hautom / Kasuto commentary, there's a lot more to it as well. And so the Kasuto commentary, you can actually buy it off of Magnus Publications for Genesis. It's part of Genesis and also the Book of Exodus. Very, very interesting. I've spent hours reading these books. Fascinating stuff. And also want to mention another man, another Italian Jew. It's very interesting, all these Italian Jews, how they came up with, which is Shmuel David Luzzatto. Luzzatto, the name Luzzatto is very famous because of the Ramchal Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, who was a Kabbalist, an Italian Kabbalist, and he wrote several very interesting books like Mesilat Yesharim, Path of the Righteous, and Olchot Tzadikim, which is Path of the Righteous, which is a quasi-Kabbalistic book. And he also wrote another book called Mesilat Yesharim, which is the paved way of the upright. Basically, it's really a book that is there to teach people how to become very righteous people, very righteous men and women. And but the Olchot Tzadikim is more of a Olchot Tzadikim is someone else. Sorry about that. He wrote Derech Hashem, the way of God, which is the quasi Kabbalistic book. The Olchot Tzadikim is a similar book to Mesilat Yesharim, but not the same. But the point is, I'm going a rabbit trail here. The Luzzatto, the Shaddai, he also wrote a very scientific commentary, and he has a commentary on the Torah which has been fascinating to read. I have the one volume version. I don't know if it's ever been translated into English, but it's a very common commentary amongst quasi scholars, especially in religious circles. When I was ultra orthodox, it was one of the to go commentaries that a lot of people had when they went to read something which wasn't the traditional commentary. But he was the old world scholars. So there's stuff that he writes that I strongly disagree with. But in any case, old doesn't mean bad. It's just in certain cases, they just had certain premises they worked on, which they worked according to, that in my opinion, create a very questionable methodology in the way they worked. The same thing about document hypothesis. That really belongs to the old world. It was the breaking of religion, and therefore it became very important to a lot of people. And there's a reason I'm building up here about scientific interpretation, because there's something very important I have to say about the temple. And basically, things like document hypothesis, it's old world school, but it works well for a lot of scholars because it kind of releases them from religion. But there, anyone who really studies document hypothesis, as you've seen, I've spoken about this quite a few times, there are a lot of issues with it. The next generation after Philhausen were already asking questions about what their teacher was doing. So there's a lot to say about it. It's a large subject to deal with. Now, why did I bring up all these scientific commentaries? I started off as a child with these two booklets, these yellow booklet and the blue booklet. I think the yellow one was the priestly garments, and the blue one was the tools themselves. I have no idea what these booklets are these days. Remember, these are wood paper based books that from back in the early 80s that probably disintegrated by then, since then. But in any case, these commentaries used a lot of the traditional Jewish commentaries on what the vestments look like. And when I was studying this and I was looking how they drew the altar and the priestly garments and the way the cherubs are supposed to look and so on, I mean, I was fascinated because, you know, like many of us, I seeked at a very young age, and I'm not patting myself on the back, it's the truth, I was seeking from a very young age the closeness of God. And there's a reason for it. I think some people who have been abused will identify with this. So here's a tender moment of confession. I was bullied as a kid. bullied very badly, to a point where I was so injured that it was questioned if I should be taken to the hospital. So, you know, I felt oppressed. I felt that I was being bullied for no reason, because I was a good boy. I was, you know, my grades were terrible, but it's because I couldn't concentrate in school because I was being bullied all the time. So when I felt as if, you know, if I seek the temple and if I seek the closeness of God, I'll be protected. Because as children, we also read a lot of Psalms, and we were encouraged to read Psalms. I remember reading Psalms that mentioned the whole thing of God protecting and God being the father of those who are oppressed. I was seeking closeness of God. I mean, today when I retrospect about it, I think that was what was really going on. Just as a side note, the kids who bullied me, several years later when we all grew up, many of them looked up to me and apologized. So it had a happy end. And believe me, I'm not scarred in any form, shape, or way. Well, you can never walk away from something like this without scars, but excuse me, my throat is being funny again. It's the weather here in Israel has been kind of crazy, so it's up and down, hot, cold, it messes around with your voice. And the thing is that I think that many of us can identify with this subject, because as people of faith, we always believe that there's a higher power. But you can never walk away with something like this without scars. So yes, I get upset with certain people sometimes because I think they're repeating the whole bullying thing. And really, when you think about it, the righteousness a priest is supposed to represent, the righteousness of the ones who uphold the Torah, Levites. You know, I knew I was a Levite from a very young age. Remember, it was really funny because I didn't know for many years. And then at a certain age, my father was called up. I didn't understand the concept of being a Levite. I mean, I knew that Halevi was the family title, but I didn't really understand what it meant until one day I saw my father being called up to the Torah scroll, and he was called up as a Levi, and suddenly something sparked in my head. I mean, I always knew it, but I didn't understand what it meant. And then I realized there was something more to it than just Cohen and Levi and this division of positions in the people. And it's that really sparked. I mean, that's when everything was like fireworks. It exploded. And I started asking myself a lot of questions. And that's where I really started pushing, because, wait, if I'm a Levite, I need to know what I'm supposed to do. So I need to learn what this temple is and so on. Because really the temple is in a different sphere. There's an interesting thing about the sphere of the temple. And another subject we'll talk about now as well. But I remember it was very important for me to really understand this. But the problem I had was at one point when I was reading the description of what the vestments look like in the biblical text, and when I was looking at comparing images, because we had these books that the school gave us and books a really interesting, beautiful book that my teacher was using. We can't find that book anymore. It was a very beautiful, but yet very simple imagery of the Mishkan. I remember seeing models of the Mishkan. One of my teachers even bought a model to the school. One of my better teachers when I was a kid, most of my teachers when I was a kid were great. There was a few of them were terrible. One of them to this very day is afraid of even seeing me. Probably very embarrassed. I tried to explain to her it's okay, but in any case, my childhood wasn't that great, put it that. But we all learn to grow out of it. But I remember seeing the models and everything, realizing there are discrepancies between the different people. And nowadays, as a scholar, as a person very seasoned in this field, and there's very little people can surprise me with when it comes to certain subjects, it's very interesting still some of the things that come out when we discuss the temple. So first thing is, what is the temple? If you take a Jewish classic view, it is the classic Bible view is Ve'asu li mikdash v'shachanti betocham. Okay? This is something which appears later on in the book of Exodus. They will make me a temple and I will dwell amongst them. That's where, by the way, the term Shekhinah comes from. Shekhinah is not a separate entity. People talk about the Shekhinah. They start talking about it as feminine because it has a na at the end. The kamatzeti makes it feminine. Start talking about it as if it's a separate entity and stuff like that. No. I'm very against that interpretation. It's a manifestation of the presence of God. It's not a separate entity. Okay, it's the same thing, for example, with this whole thing known as the wisdom, where wisdom in the book of Mishlei is considered to be like a separate thing, that to a point where some midrashim talk about the wisdom being an entity before God and so on. And wisdom in the ancient world was perceived that way, but that's just wisdom. It's a metaphor. Here, a lot of people take the whole thing of the Shekhinah and turn it into like, the spirit or something. Each person does a different manipulation of it. We need to understand from a biblical perspective, there's only God. And there are manifestations of his presence. There are messengers / angels. There's the presence itself, which is a cloud. But the thing is, there's no entity known as the Shekhinah. This is a very, very late term that we find in the Roman period. And there could be an influence from the outside on how they understood this term known as this term of the presence of God. But when we look at the way God appears in the different temples, if it's the tabernacle or if it's the temple King Solomon, or even some of the mentality about the second temple, which is a whole subject by itself. But even then, they expected fire to come from the heavens or a cloud to fill the structure, which are both manifestations of which we hear in Exodus of the presence of God, which is the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. So the temple is a place where God doesn't necessarily dwell, but he has a presence there. And that's the thing. The temple is, you can call it the house of God. And that's how we find it in a lot of places. It's referred to as Hichal Adonai, Beit Adonai, specifically using the Tetragrammaton. The term Mikdash, which is the more, the term we hear more, like Beit HaMikdash, it's a very late term. Most of the time, the term Mikdash is used as a place of holiness, a place where there's a holy dwelling, but it's not that God lives there. God is not limited to this temple. There is a presence. There's a presence. His presence is maybe more there, but when we go into, for example, just after the Ten Commandments, and I spoke about this when we did Yitro, we have the whole subject of, you build an altar, and I will come there and bless you. And the idea behind this is that really God is not limited to a space. So the question is raised, why did they even build a Mishkan? Why? What was the point of building a place of Shekhinah, a place of dwelling? Shekhinah in the term of the verb, not the noun. From the word shachan, to actually dwell. And the thing is that really in truth, there's an interesting midrash that says in the beginning there was no plan. And I don't remember exactly where I read this midrash. I mean, I've read so much literature, I can't remember exactly where everything is. But I think Rashi makes this point, and Rashi is heavily based on midrashim. A lot of people treat Rashi as the absolute commentator, and the answer is no. Rashi is heavily based on midrashim. So you have to be very careful with Rashi. There are actually entire classes you can give about the commentary of Rashi, but the one thing I can say about Rashi, if you don't know who Rashi is, it's Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. He is a 12th century Jewish commentator from France. He's very popular because he wrote commentaries on almost the entire Bible. So when the printers printed his material, it was mostly because he was the fullest commentary that can exist. He wrote about everything. And even places where he didn't write, his students made sure that there's a commentary by his teachings or by his method. So really, Rashi is not the final word. There are a lot of different commentators, but Rashi is very popular, especially in Orthodox circles. I personally, as a personal note, like reading Rashi, but don't think that he's on the spot all the time. There are places where he says things which are obviously not pshat. No matter what you do, it's obviously not pshat. It's not even in direction of pshat. And Rashi, if I remember correctly, because I remember reading this in Rashi, because Rashi was a very prominent commentator when I was a child, he says that the thing was that God didn't want to build a temple. He wanted Israel to have a relationship with him in the sense of, you build altars in locations and I will come and bless you as long as you're devoted to me and you're loyal to my Torah. But after the sin of the golden calf, because I don't like using the term golden heifer. Heifer is feminine. This is an egil. It's male. The need came. Now, I and that's why the temple was built. Now, this is depends on the order of the sections in this parasha. Is it possible that the story of the golden calf was why did people even use the term heifer? Interesting. I just suddenly went through my head. Maybe, sorry, this went through my head. Most people don't use the term heifer. They say golden calf. So, okay, my bad. In any case, the thing is that some people understand that the story of the golden calf is sandwiched between two sections, so the book doesn't end with something bad. That really this command to build the temple comes after the golden calf. So there's this opinion called En Mukdamu Meuchar BaTorah, that the order sometimes is changed deliberately. If this is true, then okay. It also explains why we have a separation between the command to build the Mishkan and the fulfillment. Because usually in the Tanakh, when there's a command, the fulfillment appears almost immediately after, unless there's a need to separate them. In this case, there seems to be a need. But on the other hand, temples were a very common thing in the ancient world. There were several types of temples. There were open temples. There were closed temples. There were temples where the axis was a straight line. There were temples where the axis was a 90-degree, which meant the Holy of Holies was to the side. If you entered the temple, you could not see the Holy of Holies. The Mishkan is really structured very similarly to other temples that existed in the ancient world, like, for example, a straight line, a rectangular structure with a Holy of Holies in the back and a holy in the front. Basically, it fits what we know about the Torah, that there are things that the Torah does which are the same in the ancient world, and there was no need to reinvent the wheel. You work with existing parameters and you just give it your own twist. And what is one of the twists here? You don't have a statue. We don't have a statue in the back of the temple. You have something completely different there. But in any case, the idea of a temple itself was a place that people could worship, was a place where they could connect to their God. It was a place where they believed that God dwelt. And we know, for example, that other cultures did the same thing. They believed that God was literally there. For example, in the daily devotion in Egypt, it was a ceremony which was the daily devotion. And what they would do there is that they would treat the god as if he's actually living there. They would dress the god, they would clean, they would bathe him, dress him, put on certain elements of makeup, put food in front of him, remove the food, put him back into his chamber, put food in front of his chamber a couple times a day. And this was very common in the ancient world. These practices, by the way, do not exist in the Israelite temple. So there are massive differences. But what we learn from these practices is that they believed that the gods actually live in these temples. This is their homes. And the fact that a god may have several temples wasn't something they had difficulty with, because the statue was a representation. So there's a few questions here about how pagans understood their religions, but they believed that their god can, through the ceremony of the opening of the mouth, which was a washing of the mouth and then putting oil there, depending on the area. Sometimes it was just washing, but some cases, from what I know, they would also put oil on the mouth. That was a ceremony that caused the manifestation of the deity. And in Israel, we don't hear anything like this, but what we learn from this is that they believe that the gods will actually live in that temple. By the way, just so you should know, many gods had only one temple, and these were variants of these gods. So basically, you need to understand that unlike Israel, where there's only one god, in a lot of nations, you had gods for cities, which meant you had a variant of a well-known major god, but you had your own version of it because you had your patron god. Which meant that even if, for example, your neighboring city has Baal of whatever, you know, Baal of this city and then Baal of that city, they perceived them as being the same god, but yet different. And therefore, they didn't have a problem with the idea, oh, they have their own Baal, we have our Baal, but, you know, there's no problem of sharing here because it's really two different gods. Or that they claimed they had the god with them and the other city didn't. I mean, there's, so for example, there's quarrels we know in Mesopotamia between these different cities, and some cities basically had their god and they believe that they have the real case of that god, and they also made certain claims, like, for example, if my god is the god of such and such, he has these lands in this area, and therefore, because we represent that god, we own those lands. And another city in front of them says, no, we have that god, and therefore those lands are ours. Or our god is the god of those lands. Whatever the case may be, we do see that they kind of believe that they had their own god. But in Israel, it was different. You really have only one god. And this is why you can't say that the god of Israel is limited to this temple. It's a place of dwelling. It's one of the places of dwelling. Which raises a whole question about the whole idea of only having one temple and so on, which is, as I've said before, is a very, very broad subject. But a temple basically is a place where you can come in contact with your god. You can come in contact with God, you can be there, you can do a service there and so on, but he's not limited just to there. Which is, by the way, one of the big discussions that went on, especially in ancient Israel, where people said, why only this one temple? We have a tradition of worshiping in different sites. So, for example, during the Second Temple period, you should know there were more temples. There were two temples in Egypt, by the way, for those who don't know. There was a temple of Elephantine and a temple of the land of Chonio. The Temple of Elephantine was destroyed relatively early, but the Temple of Chonio stood until the year 73. It was destroyed by the Romans in the year 73 because they were concerned that this temple can function as another center for rebellion. But there were other temples as well, and actually created a discussion amongst Jews during that period, very similar to the discussions today. Do we need to be part of the land of Israel? And do we need to be part of this temple to be Jewish? Or being Jewish is just keeping the Torah and keeping pure-blooded Jews, basically keeping the genealogies going. And believe me, things repeat themselves over and over again. So a lot of the discussions we have today in Torah-keeping circles are the same discussions they had back then. There is nothing, literally nothing new here. It's just a new version of it. But in any case, so that's what a temple is. It's another place that a person can come in contact with. But when we look at the Song of the Sea, it says, you know, Nachita bechazdecha amzuk gaalta. But no, there's later on in the song, it goes and it says that that he will bring them to his Hal Kodshecha, to your holy mountain, which is not necessarily one mountain. It really probably refers to the entire land, because one of the things about the land of Israel, it's a mountainous land. So there are a lot of mountains here, or, you know, quasi mountains for the modern scholars, and the idea is that the entire land is really the temple of God, that the entire land is acceptable as a place of worship. And what happened during the times of King David was relatively a new thing, and this is why the northern tribes were very, not only northern tribes, but a lot of people were upset with this idea of having one temple. They said, no, we don't do it this way, which raises an interesting question about what does the Torah really say. As I've said before, what does the Torah really say about the temple? Is it really only one? Is Deuteronomy really speaking about one temple? Or do we actually say that Exodus is the real core of it? And Exodus says there's more than one place you can worship at, and Deuteronomy actually agrees with that, but it's worded in a way that makes it sound as if there's only one temple. It's a very interesting subject. I've had a lot of debates with my professors about this. I've even written papers against this interpretation, and, you know, it's an interesting subject. And I might share some of these papers just to clarify some of this. So this parasha, now I'm actually going to the parasha itself. This parasha is known as parasha Truma. Truma is from the root rum, which is to lift up, which basically means to lift up something and take it somewhere. And the truma is a word, by the way, which is used to describe what you give the temple itself or the priest. So there's actually a difference between ma'aser and truma. A ma'aser, or the tithe, is really something you give the Levites. A truma is something you give the temple slash the priests. And there's a difference. Priests don't actually receive tithe. There actually is no such thing as tithe for priests. In the Second Temple period, the priests stole the tithe from the Levites because, well, a lot of politics and stuff like that, and they were trying to usurp power. And some of the priests were very upset with a lot of Levites that refused to come back to the land after the exile. But believing there was a lot of politics involved in this, and a lot of Levites did show up at one point. But the priests in the Second Temple were not that great. I'm going to be very blunt. When you read the history of the Second Temple, especially the early history, which I've just finished a course in, you see that there are a lot of issues with them. So they actually stole the tithe and made claims about the tithe and the temple itself, which fit their agenda instead of actually fitting what the Torah actually says. So it says, it starts going, it says gold, silver, copper, very common. Tchelet, also known as Tekiltu in Akkadian, it's actually blue, but the reason I'm saying the word blue over and over again, because I want to say it's a blue color. It's not necessarily from a specific dye. We know that in the ancient world, there were different grades of blue, and there was the most expensive blue, which is made from the mollusk, and there is the cheaper blue, and purple, by the way, or red, because argaman can be anything like a dark red or a maroon or purple, because they're definitions of colors. For example, Josephus says that the tola'at shani, the crimson, is like fire. He describes it as fire. And what he's really referring to is the orange. But crimson, some people think crimson is red. But really, in truth, the descriptions that we have of crimson is really more the orangey color. But these are actually three colors. Tchelet, argaman, tola'at shani, they actually come from live animals. They can come from live animals as well. And we know there was such a production. So tchelet and argaman actually came from a mollusk or from plant-based dyes, like, for example, the ones that came from India. The first blue dyes in the ancient world actually came from India, and they were plant-based. In Egypt, because they used linen, and they actually despised the smell that comes from working with these mollusks. In Egypt, they would actually use plant-based dyes. I mean, we have inscriptions that talk about the dyers and how they smell and things like that, but the majority of Egyptians didn't like the idea of the smell, so it was considered to be a very bad profession. But the other side of it as well is, chemically speaking, the substance that comes out from the mollusk doesn't cling to anything besides wool. But if Israel came from Egypt and Egyptians preferred linen, and they did, there's a good chance that this was also linen-based. That there was actually, most of the clothing was actually, or the tools used in the temple were actually mostly made out of linen and not wool. Because very commonly people talk about, you know, how did they have shesh, which is a mixture, which is basically linen. It's another word for linen. And I think it's the Egyptian word for linen, if I'm not mistaken. Shashu, something like that. I can't remember exactly. And how could they do that together with the tchelet and argaman, which traditionally people say is made out of wool? The high quality stuff, which is made from the mollusk, is made out of wool. And my response to this usually is, probably was not wool. There's a good chance it was not wool. Traditionally speaking, when you look at commentators from figures, even from the time of the Second Temple, they speak that the mixture of linen and wool was forbidden for everyone, was allowed in temple, and therefore the priestly garments were made of it. It was part of the holy sphere. But the answer is that no, actually the temple, which represents also to some degree the Garden of Eden, where there is order, why would God allow a mixture, something which is the disorder? Because the prohibition of mixing plant-based substances with animal-based substances is the concept of chaos. The temple is a concept of order. So I from also a philosophical point of view, because I have spoken about this, that there are esoteric concepts in the Torah. There are. They do exist. There's a cosmology here that a lot of people are very unaware of. And one of these things is the concept that the Torah is order. The Torah is light. This is why they also refer to the Torah as oraita, which is basically another word for light. And it's an Aramaic word for light. And the thing is that putting a concept of chaos, which is mixing wool and linen together, doesn't make sense in the cosmology of the temple. So we have the shesh and we have the izim. Izim is goat hair, but goat hair was never woven with anything else. Goat hair was usually made as a separate item. And then we have oils and so on, things you can read by yourself. There's also, a lot of people ask me about the anointing oil. Anointing oil, we need to, there are 11, in the Torah itself, it mentions more like 3 or 4 substances, but in Jewish tradition, it says that there were 11 spices that were put into the oil. But people ask me, can you make anointing oil today? And the answer is, you're not allowed to. If you make anointing oil, and you make it according to the recipe of the Torah, you've actually violated what the Torah says. It is only to be made in the temple. And I've seen people sell these veils of anointing oil. And I actually walked in and I said, how dare you? And they said, what do you mean? I said, how dare you sell this item? And the thing is that they said to me, oh, they mix in a few other things like water and stuff like that to not make it as the Torah ascribes. And I said, good for them, but there's a problem. You're actually promoting the idea of production of this oil outside of the temple sphere. This is a problem. It's the same way the Torah says, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. We're not allowed to make this even in our regular life. The Torah forbids it from also being consumed, as it says in Deuteronomy. It's the same thing here. You're allowing yourself to make something outside of its permissible sphere. You can't do that. I was very upset with the people who do this. The Temple Institute, which by the way is one of the organizations I used to work with, I used to study, actually was in the first class they had back in 2001, the first class of the yeshiva, which developed today into the research, I don't actually exist anymore, but it was for a while a research center of the Temple Institute, where I was actually the beginning of it. I wasn't one of the establishers, but I was one of the first students there. In time, they decided to really work more with rabbis and people who are a lot more trained. But I was a student there. It was a very interesting time. But the Temple Institute, for example, when they sell the collection of spices for the ktoret, for the incense, they separate them out, which is a smart thing to do. So we have here also different types of jams. The Temple Institute went through a whole thing to try to reconstruct the Choshen. The problem is that the names that appear here in the Torah are not the same names we have today. When, so for example, when it says, you know, that Reuven has an Odem, it doesn't necessarily have to be a ruby. I actually spoke with someone who's a jeweler, but he's also a jeweler who deals with antiquity. And I asked him about the gold production, about the menorah, which is going to be part of the discussion today. I think this recording is going to be very, very long. Or I might have to break this up into several recordings to really discuss the whole thing about the temple, the vestments and everything. So we might do this over several recordings and take do this week part of it, next week the next part, and the week after that just talk about the next parasha, but then continue the subject of the temple into the next two parashot. So we might have a very long series here about the temple, maybe even 4 recordings about the temple. We'll see how we manage this. But the thing is, I spoke with this jeweler and I asked him about the stones, and I asked a rabbi who I used to work with, who was heavily involved with the subject of the temple. And we even managed together a small museum in Jerusalem, on Chabad Street in Jerusalem, just above the Kaldo. We had a model of the Third Temple, and we had different items there. And the thing that really came up in this discussion, and a friend of mine who's also a researcher in this field went to ask the person who did some of the work for the Temple Institute over the Choshen, and we actually were exposed to some. I actually saw some of the first images of the Choshen, of the breastplate, some of the first images before anyone saw anything in the world about the priestly vestments. I saw pictures. It was fun. I mean, it was amazing because it's something that has not been in existence for a very, very long time. And it was just amazing. I mean, I remember the discussions we had about the temple and bringing these things into life. I mean, I wasn't involved in the actual production, but we were shown pictures. We were asked questions, what we think about it. And it was very, very exciting because we were part of something that has not been around for a very long time. I mean, priestly vestments, which are the discussion of next week's recording, was something amazing. It was amazing to me, some of the stuff that was going on there. But then when we researched the whole thing of the stones, even Rabbi Ariel and back then even Rabbi Makovil were the two main lead characters about this subject, because Rabbi Richman was less involved in that part of it, at least as far as I know. They admitted that it was very difficult to find the stones, and they were trying, so they were working off of certain elements they could work with. Now, people were amazing. People were sending them in. People who had were sending in stones. Like, for example, the stone of Binyamin was considered to be a colorful stone, and they couldn't find one. They couldn't find one. This lady, I think it was from Australia, sent them, said, I have something like that. So people from around the world contributed to reconstructing these things. I do apologize for the coughing and everything. There's not much I can do about it. And it was just amazing. It was astonishing how people were. And we heard the stories firsthand. Like one day Rabbi Ariel looks in and says, you wouldn't believe what happened today. What? What happened, Rabbi? And he says to us, someone sent us a ruby. It's like, what? Rubies are expensive. No, someone sent us a big chunk of ruby. Or, you know, someone sent us this colorful stone. But the one thing they realized, they were unable to really reconstruct the names of these stones. So they had to work off of also traditions of colors and everything. So I remember at one point Rabbi Ariel admitted, he said, actually, there was a conference back in 2001 when they came out in public with a lot of these things. And they said, they explained that they were doing research, and they think that they found the correct stones. But they said the names in the Bible never survive. We don't really 100% know what these names are. So there are a lot of things that fall in the realm of speculation. But we have, it mentions, basically we have things that we can reconstruct and the things that we can't really reconstruct in full. Gold, we know what gold is. We know what silver is. We know what brass is. Actually, the word nechoshet can be brass, can be copper, can be bronze. I'm going to say it's probably more copper, because bronze is a mixture of copper together with certain elements of iron that was mostly used in the industry of making weapons. So they were harder. I think here, if the gold is pure, probably the silver is pure, and probably the copper is pure as well. So it's really copper, not bronze. But this is also the end of the Bronze Age. We're reaching the end of the Bronze Age, or the middle of the Bronze Age. I mean, if we're talking about, say, 1400, so it's the late Bronze Age. So we're actually looking towards the end of the Bronze Age, which, based on the typical chronology, ends Bronze Age ends around 1200, and then Iron Age the first Iron Age begins around 1200, because it's based on what kind of tools they were using. So we start off with the Ark. Now, who hasn't seen Indiana Jones? Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. I remember seeing that movie as a kid. And I loved it. I mean, you know, melting Nazis and everything. But I loved the whole thing, because someone actually made a model of the Ark. And that model, by the way, shows... they actually reused that model several times in other movies as well. But I remember seeing the Ark itself. And I was looking at the design. And I go, there are some elements of design here which are wonderful. And there are some elements of design here who are questionable. And the Ark, first of all, what is the Ark? The Ark is probably the biggest anomaly in the entire subject of the temple. Why? The cherubs. On the one hand, God says, don't make any beings on the earth or in the heavens or on the water under the earth. But then there's a question here. What about the cherubs? Well, the answer is very simple. The cherubs are not on this earth, and therefore are not a manifestation of something that exists here, and therefore are not prohibited. This is why using cherubs as a decoration in a temple was not a problem. But on the other hand, unlike, for example, the Palace of Samaria, which is probably an 8th century palace, probably from King Ahab, where he had images of cherubs on the wall in ivory, the cherubs are a divine, belong to the divine realm, and therefore have no place in the human realm, have no place in human temples. Now, kings in the ancient world, they perceive themselves as divine. For example, the Sumerians, there's a Sumerian king list, very, very long list, but kings that lived thousands and thousands of years. Obviously, nonsense, but a lot of kings perceive themselves as being of divine origins. And that created also worship of kings, but that we have images. There's, for example, a chair that was discovered, a Phoenician chair that was discovered, that has cherubs on the side. Cherubs are presented not the presence of a deity, but his chariot, what he rides upon. And the idea is that the cherubs are basically, I wouldn't say throne, because he doesn't sit there. It was the place where his feet would stand. It was actually a pedestal. It says, "Hashamayim kisi v'ha'aretz hadom raglai." It says, I think in Isaiah, it says, "The heavens are my throne and the earth is my pedestal." Only the feet of God are really, quote unquote, feet of God are really on the cherubs. It's not the full presence of God. It's only his feet. People always speak about, for example, I heard this over and over again when I was working in the museum, in the Temple Museum, not Temple Institute, by the way, do not confuse it. It's a different organization. People always talk about the mercy throne, the mercy throne. I'm like, what mercy throne? This is not a throne. This is a pedestal. This is where his feet touch. And when you look at the ancient world, how they depicted their gods, the gods didn't sit on the beings that carried them. They always stood. And you know what? Go to India today and you still see the same thing. Go to Egypt. You have images of gods riding on animals. Even one god that rides on a rat. Or maybe I think maybe that might be even from India. So the cherubs who stand there are not a throne. They're actually a pedestal. And God's feet stand there, and that's the we only get to see the feet of God. Okay? We don't get to, God is not fully there. As I said, this is only a presence of him. It's not him himself. He's not limited to this place. His feet touch there. And this is what he rides upon. Okay? There's a verse that says, Yosheva Koruvim Hofia, the one who sits on the cherubs has arrived. But it's not that he sits on the cherubs. He sits on his throne, which the cherubs carry. So if it's not his feet, it's his throne, but it's not the fullness of him. So you can't refer to the cherubs as a seat. It's a carrier of something. And it's something, if we look, for example, at Isaiah 6, it talks about cherubs flying next to him, but never being above him. Because the cherubs are the thing that lifts him, the item that carries him. You look at Ezekiel, and you have the cherubs carrying him. But it's not his throne. They carry the throne. They are under his feet. That's the first thing, at least, that I see in this. Then the cherubs themselves. So in Indiana Jones, they actually probably depicted the cherubs correctly with straight wings. Why? Because there were basically two ways you can describe a cherub. The Egyptian way with straight wings, or the Phoenician way, where the wings were behind and they curled up at the tip. So it raised the question what the cherubs actually look like. Were they human-like, the way the Egyptians would describe them? Or were they more sphinx-like? Or were they more like a combination of animal and man? It actually has a term, and I don't remember what the term is. But were they more Phoenician or were they more Egyptian? And we actually don't know. But the depiction in Indiana Jones, if they were more human, then I would assume they looked more like the Egyptians. So straight wings, touching one another, maybe slightly tilted to kind of like create a cover over the kaporet, which is the covering, because kapara is not atoning. It really means to cover. So the kaporet, which is the covering, might have had the wings slightly tilted. If they were more like the Phoenicians, then the wings would come from the back and not as the arms, and they would curl up over the head and touch one another. Now, there's a lot of discussion about the cherubs themselves, And a lot of Midrashim talk about the cherubim being one male, one female, one representing God, one represented Israel, female representing Israel, and that it represents the covenant between Israel and God. But if we think about it as being the throne or the pedestal, we have a possibility that the gender is of no meaning, of no consequence. Literally no consequence. There is no meaning whatsoever to the gender. And they could have been genderless. And really, we never hear of gender of angels. I mean, in late angelology, or whatever they want to call it, the study of angels, they start talking about male, female, and stuff like that. But in truth, I think there really is no discussion about the gender. Yes, the idea of them being male and female is a nice idea, but it's probably pointless at this period in Israel, because we need to remember, as I said, with the booklets, they represent a very late interpretation of what these things actually look like. But the chances are that the concepts they worked by were completely different. So I'm trying to work through the archaeology that I've studied. I deliberately took courses in archaeology, or course in archaeology, but it was really more than just one course, where we discussed art. We actually had to look at a lot of images of art, also a lot of pottery, but a lot of art as well, especially art from the land of Israel. And what's interesting, the only representations that we have of cherubs that we can actually see from the land of Israel are more the Phoenician. But we need to remember, this is a Phoenician influence. The Israelites came out of Egypt. So this is why I actually like what they did in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I understand it sounds kind of funny, but sometimes people really hit things correctly. Now, you also have some of the famous images that you have from the Temple Institute, but the wings are so big and the cherubs are so big that the amount of gold needed to produce this is so immense, and the weight would be almost in the area of a ton. I actually spoke with someone, a mathematician, who did a calculation of the size and everything, and he said, this thing could weigh a ton easily. So the cherubs were probably much, much smaller. And again, this is where I like what they did in Raiders of the Lost Ark, because the cherubs there are relatively small. And the chances are that these were very, very small cherubs. And they weren't as big as you would think. And they weren't these massive wings and everything. They were probably very simple, very small, and the wings were the emphasis. And the wings were probably very thin as well. Everyone depicts these things as massive, with big ornaments on the sides of everything. No, we're probably looking at flat surfaces with engravings onto the gold. And also, it wasn't gold layered, it was in several boxes. There were exterior box and interior box. And we know this because we actually have boxes like this, holy boxes that come from Egypt. They don't have a lid the same way that the kapolet has. It doesn't have the same lid with the cherubs, but they're cherubs or cherub-like, more like snake women, which snakes were actually a protective symbol in Egypt, with straight wings on the side. So we actually have examples of what the ark might have looked like, based on what we know from Egyptian art, which is probably the main influence on Bezalel and his team. Now this ark's supposed to be carried, and there are different ways of carrying boxes like this. For example, the Egyptians sometimes would put a box on a flat surface, and the flat surface will have the poles. Here it's very clear that there are rings on the sides, either on the top or the bottom. There are different arguments about where it was. And it says, Vevetet abadim, abad, which, by the way, in modern Hebrew means cloth. In biblical Hebrew, actually means a pole, wooden pole. Batabot ala tzlaot. So a tzela means the side, the corner of something. But the question is, was it on top or was it on the bottom? I would contest it was on the bottom part of the ark, because we know that in the ancient world, they would carry, like I said, the Egyptians would carry this on a platform. So they always expected the box to be higher than everyone else. So I would say that it was on the bottom. Then there's the whole question of, did this thing have legs? And the answer is probably not, because again, I look at what the Egyptians had, and the boxes didn't have any legs. No legs whatsoever. So that's about the ark. Then we have the table. Now, people ask, why a table? We need to remember that temples were dwelling places for gods. And the temple is really designed almost like a king's court. You know, God doesn't live in his temple. He doesn't live there. But there are elements there that represent a king's court. So when a priest goes into a temple, he's like one of the servants of a king. So a king has his throne. He has the food that's placed before him. Many kings are depicted as having a table in front of them where they eat. Many kings had incense burners. It was a very, very common thing. And obviously a king will also need some light. So the temple itself, the vestments of the temple represent a king's court, not a house in the same sense, because though some of the elements there also fit what kings had in their houses. But as I said, this is only a dwelling place in a certain way. So I wouldn't look at this as the house of God, as this is where he lives. So for example, there's no bed. There's a throne. There's no bed. A king's house, usually they would have a bed there. But a king, when he's in front of his servants, in front of his people, he sits. He doesn't lay down. This is why I say this is not a house where he lives. This is his court. This is his palace. And the table. So the table of showbread, the way it's depicted in Judaism, if you look at Temple Institute, for example, a table, there's an actual table, which is great. And I think the ancient world, this was very common. They always put food in front of the gods. What's interesting, the food is not in front of the actual thing. It's actually to the side. The understanding is it was placed to the side. And each thing put stood in a different location where the incense burner or the gold altar was more into the front. And then they were to the side and a little bit backwards, more towards the entrance or front or back, whatever you want to call it. And the table usually is said to be on the right-hand side of one who enters the temple, and which means it was on the north. And because if that's west, if you face west, north is to your right, south is to your left. So the menorah was to your left. And the table of the showbread was actual table. But then there is a whole bunch of instruments here, like ke'arot, which are bowls, kapot, which are spoons, kasavot and menekiot. Here, the kasavot and the menekiot are interpreted as being these parts, these external parts, which are added to the table. So the kasavot are understood to be these holder devices on the side. Either there's some depictions where it's like these flat planks of gold, wood with gold, or like little pillars, and then these straw-like things come between that basically create little shelves. And they were all the bread was standing up high with air flowing between them and everything. In truth, I contest this interpretation. All these tools which are described here sit on the table itself, and it says, "Asher yusach bahen," which different libations and offerings are done on the table, because this is a table that's supposed to represent something which someone would presumably eat from. So the table has the breads themselves, and the description of the breads being, you know, with a special shape where they were folded on the edges and everything, probably not true. This, when it comes to some of the vestments, especially the table of the showbread and the menorah, I actually side with the scholars. I actually side with the Christian descriptions of what the vestments look like, what these tools look like, because of the problem of when you read the verses, when you look at what traditional interpretation is, it presents these things, your eyebrow hits the ceiling. It doesn't fit. It doesn't fit the words. So I think the table, the way I understand it, is the table was a table, a certain height, everything that we have here, a cubit. There's a lot of interpretations of what a cubit is. For example, the Egyptians had huge cubits as well, which were 7 fists, but this was a 7 fists, which was basically the size of a regular person's fist, not my fist, because my fists are pretty big, but the size of an average person, and then you would have anything between 5 and 7. There was a cubit for structures, there was a cubit for instruments, and there was a cubit for the layman. So the 6 fists was more for important things, the 5 fists was like for regular people, 7 fist cubit was usually for royal projects. So there were different types of cubits in the ancient world. We don't know which one the Israelites used, by the way. but you can find rulers. I used to have in my possession a ruler of an Egyptian cube with all the writings and all the things that can be said about it, all the notations about what it is. And the bread was probably regular bread. We're talking about probably round loaves of bread. Bread, for those who don't know, was mostly made round. Though we do know that they did find archaeology, for example, bakeries that they discovered, but there were other shapes as well. But very commonly, bread was round because it's the easiest shape to do. You don't need a tool to make a round. Just make it round. As a person who worked as a baker and as a chef for several years, and I baked a lot of bread, it was always easier to make something round. And it's called a lechem. It doesn't tell us how thick it was. If this was what we refer to as challah, so challah comes from the word chalul, which is something which has holes in it. It's puffy, but this is unleavened bread, which means these were probably crackers of some sort. So I don't know how thick they were, but these were probably not big, hefty loaves of bread. These were probably normal size loaf of breads, probably round, and they were stacked up one atop of the other. Now it's referred to as the table of the shortbread, lechem hapanim. So they start talking in the midrashim about that it has many faces and so on. But really, it means the bread of it's the bread of the presence. It's the bread that's presented before God. It's the lechem hapanim of in the face, in the presence. Because panim can also doesn't necessarily just mean face, it means presence. And it has like a little gold rim on the edges and everything. But the truth of the matter is, it's basically a simple table. The difference is it also has poles and it's carried around. And it also has tools on it, like little bowls and spoons and kasavot, or probably little jars. We need to think a little about Egypt. Think about Egypt and the little jars they had, the little cups they had. The way you sometimes look at Egyptian depictions of a home or tools that they had, and have these little tools with little oil or little cups and stuff like that. I mean, you really have to think about it, because this came out of Egypt, and I think a very strong part of how they designed things here is probably based on Egyptian designs as well. So I would say this is a regular table made out of gold. Probably some ornaments. Specifically, talks about a little gold rim on the edges, but the table itself was still looked like a table. I keep on asking this question: where do you find in the ancient world tables that you build these planks or these structures on the side to keep everything high up? I strongly contest that. I don't think that it's based on what was going on in the real world. I think that some of this is based on misinterpretation and misunderstanding of the structures of these tools. Literally, a problem with understanding how these tools are structured. By the way, regarding where the poles are, I mean, usually the poles are in many places depicted as if they go along the length of the ark and the length of the tools. But there are a lot of people, the Jewish commentators, he says, actually goes on the width. When people walked with the ark, that the cherubs were not one in the front, one in the back, but they're actually walking together. So that's one way. But again, this is more of a tradition, so it might be true, it might not be true. When I look at the Egyptian depictions, because they couldn't draw three-dimensional, they always depict them as being one in the front, one in the back, but it doesn't necessarily mean that's what they did. So there could be, again, we have to remember Israel is unique, and therefore it's possible that they did something a little different. It's very, very possible. The menorah. So as I said, this is going to be several parts. So we're going to touch on the menorah today. Next week we'll do the priestly garments, and then for Vayakhel, we'll talk about the temple itself, the structure and everything. But I want to finish with the menorah today. And the menorah, again, the way it's depicted, for example, by the Temple Institute is probably wrong. The size itself. It says you make a menorah out of a kikal of gold. That's basically like 3.4 liters of gold. That's not huge. So a friend of mine wonderful friend of mine who's a very, very talented and very, very intelligent man, we were discussing this and he said, who says the menorah was huge? Maybe the menorah was only a few, maybe a foot high. Maybe it was just a cubit high. Maybe it was a tiny little menorah, which would make it easier to make something that big. Or maybe it wasn't, maybe it was only 2 feet high and not, you know, three, four cubits high like the Temple Institute tries to present it, which, by the way, they use the bigger, they use the huge cubit as if it gives you something. I remember asking about this and they told me, oh, the reason we did this is because the it's the chumrah. It's taking more of a strict. No, who says that? There's no lechumah, you can't make it bigger. It's not like, for example, what is the size of a matzah you're supposed to be eating on the Seder night? Because you want to make sure you have the right quantity here. The Torah doesn't give you a description of how big this was. It's a latter description from the Jewish sages of what they did in the Second Temple. They had a huge menorah. But when I went, when I and my rabbi friend, who we worked together, went and asked jewelers, experts, again, these people that do, we had two guys, one was a jeweler, the other one was an antiquity dealer who happens to be a professor of economics in the Hebrew University. But I sat with him and he gave me a description of how to implement gold onto wood. And he said there are 18 different methods, 18 different known methods from the ancient world, how it was done. And he said that if people would have done the research, they would have known how to work with this correctly. And they didn't. They messed everything up. So the thing is that I asked about, you know, chandeliers and, you know, vestments like this in the ancient world. He said they weren't, I mean, we do know of like relatively big tools, but these were made of brass. He said, what about gold? He said, if they used gold, it was never huge. Because it was very heavy, it was very expensive. If you ever look at the process of how you produce gold, it's a complex process from metric tons of ores that they pull out of the ground. You only get a small quantity of gold, even in very, very rich deposits. It's a lot of work. It is a lot of work. And they knew this. So I asked, how big do you think a menorah would have been? And he said, several people said to me, probably less than the height of a human being. Probably, if it was anything, it was half the height of a human being. It wasn't that wide either. But one of the questions we had, if it's pure gold, wouldn't it bend? I mean, even if I take a solid piece of gold of 3.4 liters, which is just over a gallon, and I try to produce something that size, even if I take the most minimal size it can take, would it still be stretched out a lot? And we were told, yes, it will be stretched out a lot, but there are methods to harden gold and still keep it around the 99.1% pure, which, believe me, is pure. Even in gold standards of today, 99% is pure. And for them, what they perceived as pure might have been even less, because it says Zahav Taho, and Taho means something which is pure, which is something which is clean. So you have the base of the menorah, then you have the middle piece, the middle pole, which is the actual menorah, and then you have six branches that come out of the sides. And the assumption is it wasn't very, very big. But then we have another problem. How do you deal with the ornaments? So many years ago, a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, suggested that maybe this is really an almond tree. And I said, that's an interesting idea, because really we do have the description of cups with almonds. And it says that you have three cups with almonds on each one of the branches, and there is a button and a flower. Now, when you look at how it's described in images that we have, especially Jewish ones, they start separating and they make this very organized fashion of like three cups and this. And look, for example, at the depiction of the Rambam, which, by the way, makes a triangle menorah, which is, by the way, not the shape the menorah is supposed to be. Every time I argue with Lubavitch people about this menorah, I always get the same answer. But the Rambam drew it. And I said, if you look at the notes, the Rambam says this is a schematic depiction and do not learn from it what the menorah is supposed to look like. It's only a schematic depiction. But then he drew a triangle. And I said, I've had this discussion dozens of times, and they keep on repeating this. And I say, dude, if he wrote a note on the side, you have to pay attention to the note. It's a fundamental basic idea of reading material in general. But no, they keep on ignoring me. But anyone who actually understands Maimonides correctly, which I can't vouch for Chabad, there's stuff that they say that unfortunately they obviously don't understand what the Rambam is talking about. But especially in this case, the triangle shape, if you want to say someone said it's supposed to be a triangle, it might be Rashi. Even there, it's very vague. It was round. All the depictions we have of the menorah from everywhere is round or more or less round. The triangle is usually, if you see something triangle, it's because someone had difficulty edging a round shape, so it went something a bit more triangle. But we know every ancient depiction that we have of the menorah is actually round. The branches were round. But the thing is that the Rambam, Maimonides, he depicts the parts of the cups and the flower and everything. He kind of puts them in like a very neat, organized fashion. And the question is, is this really what's being depicted? And what my friend suggested, and I strongly agree with this, and I think some other scholars have pointed this out, we actually are probably looking at an almond tree, which, by the way, connects us to not only the almonds mentioned here, but Aaron's stuff. Why an almond tree? The almond tree keeps on showing up over and over again in imagery, with here, with Aaron's stuff, with Jeremiah. We keep on hearing about this almond tree. So this is probably an almond tree, and probably what we're looking at, these cups and the flowers and everything, they actually produce the almond flower. If you go to an almond tree and you look at it, it probably produced the almond flower. And that's what we're looking at. And the part where the candle itself sits, it actually sits on a blossom of an almond. And not this neat, organized cups with shapes of almonds drawn on them. It probably depicts the shape of an almond itself. So when it says Meshukadim, Rav Saadia Gaon actually says that they edged into the shape of the cups what an almond would look like from the exterior. A pure almond, it's a little rough on the exterior. It has like this wavy shape and everything. That it's actually supposed to depict an almond, and the cup is more of a representation of the almond itself. So, because a cup can be anything which has a shape that it can contain something. So why is it not depicting maybe the fruit itself? The concept of blossoming and then light coming out of it. And the base also has an almond flower as well. And really what we're looking at is an almond tree. I would say that the menorah is really an almond tree, and it represents something about blossoming. It's the first tree to blossom in during the winter. Maybe it's supposed to represent that even in dark times, like the almond tree, it will blossom even when it's cold and dark. And that's where the light comes out of it. It's supposed to remind us of the presence of God. And also remember that a king's palace will always have a light somewhere. Okay? So we're going to stop here because we're almost an hour and 15 minutes. It's probably the longest recording I've done on this program. And what we'll do is next week, we'll actually continue from the beginning of Parashat Tetzaveh, and we'll talk about the priestly vestments. Again, we might not cover everything. And then we also have the description of the dedication here, which I'm going to postpone to the book of Leviticus, the book of Vayikra. But don't worry, we'll get to the other parts of the temple, the different altars and everything. That will happen not next week, not the week after that. It's going to happen in about 3 weeks when we go into Vayikra, where we have the depiction of the tools themselves being made, the fulfillment of the commandment. As I said, usually there's a command and then it's fulfilled. Here there's a break in between, probably to sandwich bad news between two good pieces of news, and it was really done deliberately, and really the tabernacle was probably built after the whole story with the golden calf, because if they were commanded to build, I mean, Moses is still in Mount Sinai as well. There's a few questions about this. But anyhow, I hope you enjoyed this. I hope this has opened up some insight. I haven't gone in too deep yet into temple service or, what would the temple look like in actual action. That's something that's going to happen more in Leviticus. Hope you enjoyed this. If you have any questions, please feel free to email me, hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. And also my Facebook page, Hebrew in Israel. So you see, everything is Hebrew in Israel. And again, if you're interested in Hebrew lessons, you can contact me. Don't be afraid to learn Hebrew. It's a challenge, but also remember that you will need a teacher eventually. There's so much you can do by reading books and listening to lectures and so on. You need someone to actually train you. So feel free to contact me. Doesn't matter what level you're at, beginner, intermediate, advanced. It's always good to work on your knowledge. And also, you know, if there's an issue with the price, just tell me. We can discuss this. And you will be able to advance your knowledge not only in Tanakh, not only in Hebrew, but in general in your walk in Torah as well. I'm very neutral in the way I present things. I don't tell you what to believe in. I just give you information and you can think about it. Hope you enjoyed this and hope you can rejoin me next week on the next recording. Shabbat Shalom.